the horizontal, we will control the vertical. We can roll the image, make it flutter. We can change the focus to a soft blur, or sharp, crystal clear. For the next hour, sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear. We repeat, there is nothing wrong with your television. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits.
Simple flight. From ultralights to the edge of space. The Wright brothers flew in 1903, and aviation is still finding new ways to advance. Aviation is fun, it's business, and it's full of opportunity. Join Al Waterloo as he talks with amazing people doing amazing things in aviation.
All right, welcome to the show. Good evening, everybody. Today is August 5th, 2012, and what a great day it is underneath the Northbrook VOR. That's right, we're coming live from the Northbrook VOR here in the Chicagoland area. For those aviation geeks out there, you can look it up under Oscar Bravo Kilo. Anyway, I'm Al Waterloo. We're looking forward to a great show tonight, and we have a really special surprise tonight. We have a new co-host for the radio show, Mr. Mark Eppner.
Thank you.
All right, welcome to the show.
I didn't know we were going to have such a large studio audience.
Absolutely. We got a cast of thousands like on the old Bozo TV show.
I remember that. Actually, my son was on that show.
Are you serious?
He got to do Bozo Buckets.
Oh, wow.
But he lost to a Girl Scout, and we've never let him forget it since.
Oh, wow. That's a riot. Well, anyway, well, thanks for joining us on the show.
I'm so excited to be here. You know me. I love everything aviation. And if you had told me even on Thursday that I'd be doing this on Sunday nights, I would have told you you're nuts. And I'm very excited now to be part of the program. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. Anyway, well, it's good to have you. Do you want to start us off with any opening words? Do you have a joke or anything?
A joke? Actually, normally I would say no, but, you know, when it comes to aviation, there's some great humor out there. And I just heard one today, and it's, of course, an old joke, but I'll go with it anyway. And it actually goes back to more of that holiday spirit, Santa Claus. You may not know, but Santa Claus has the same FAA rules that we all have to do, and he even has to fly with a designated pilot examiner.
Honest to goodness.
Yeah, I know. Many people don't know that. And there was a story not too long ago, I think it was right before last year's Christmas, where it talked about how the FAA sent an examiner over there to make sure that he was set before he did his Christmas run. And so he came in about a week before that, and...
Was he from the DuPage FISDO?
I think so.
Yeah.
It took a while to get over there, but that's, you know, that's all because they were flying an Archer over there to the North Pole. But Santa had the elves wash the sled and bathe all the reindeer. He got his logbook out and sure made sure that the paperwork was in order. And he knew that they were going to examine the equipment. So he spent a lot of time getting everything in order. And sure enough, the FAA examiner came in, and he walked around the sled, and he was examining it, and then he checked the lighting, i.e. Rudolph's red nose. He checked all the reindeer, the harnesses, the landing gear, and painstakingly looked at the weight and balance because he knew the tremendous load that Santa would be carrying. And so he said, let's get in. And Santa got in, did the seat belt and the shoulder harness, and got all ready for the trip. And noticed when the examiner got on the plane, he was carrying a shotgun.
Oh, jeez. Why is that?
Well, exactly. And Santa asked, what's that for? And the examiner kind of winked at him, and he leaned over and whispered. He says, well, I'm not supposed to tell you this ahead of time, but you're going to lose an engine on takeoff. Do you like that one?
I have to I have not heard that one. And
well, see, this is a good thing. You're such a young man, and I'm such an old man. I can bring back all this old stuff. And for you, you're hearing it for the first time.
Right, right. I love it. That's awesome. Well, that is a that's a pretty awesome joke, and you know, I think everybody loved it. That was awesome. Yeah. Yeah, if I ever told a joke, I'd probably, you know, everybody would boo me off the stage like that.
Yeah, obviously we're hearing them now. They don't even like it when you talk.
Yeah, seriously. But no, that's a great joke. That's a good. Have you ever lost an engine?
I actually have not. Although I'm trying to think back, and I'm going back to the 70s. But I was on my either short or long cross country. And all of a sudden, I was, and this was in Iowa City, I was heading back from the north toward Iowa City, and just before I got to Cedar Rapids, which is about 20 miles north of Iowa City, my engine started running very rough. So I'm a student pilot, solo cross country, engine's running rough, and I'm picturing this 13-story dormitory on the way to the final approach to runway 17 in Iowa City. And so I called Cedar Rapids there and said, hey, I'd like to do a landing. I did not call an emergency. It was probably one of my best landings ever. It was a good strong headwind. It was a DC-9 from Ozark ready to take off, and I touched down on the numbers and I was stopped by the end of the number.
Oh, jeez.
But I just came in. It turned out it was a bad mag, and at that time I didn't know to like turn one mag off to see it smooth out.
Right.
But I made a landing, and so that thankfully is the closest I've ever come to an engine out.
Yeah, well, that's good. It's better than a Santa Claus. That's losing an engine, when, you know, going hunting season. I didn't know that hunting season was still open on Christmas Day, but yeah,
special rules for special guys.
Yeah, right. It's something that sounds like the DuPage FISDA would do. But anyway.
Well, you know what the FAA says. We're not happy until you're not happy.
Yeah, we're here to help.
Yeah, exactly. Go across many industries.
Yeah, true, true. That's awesome.
You know, actually, you talk about being here at the Northbrook VOR. As you can see, it's a pretty impressive VOR. It's not like one of those small ones. And I happen to live in the community, and we have all of our baseball fields here and the high school fields. And people would come in, and they'd say, they'd look at this huge disc, right? And they'd say, oh, my God, what is that? And I always said, I don't know. It wasn't here yesterday. And they always got a kick out of that.
Yeah. Well, it's some from outer space, which I'm sure that would bust at the Chicago Bravo airspace when coming into land. But maybe the DuPage FISDO met them too. They're here to help. But
yeah, and just a little bit of trivia: this is the former Nike site, and before there was a high school here, before there was baseball fields, there was silos and actually missiles here. I used to take my dog for walks on and all that, and government donated it, and we got a new high school and all these wonderful fields around here.
Yeah, awesome. Very nice. There's that's excellent. So, well, that's a great way to start the show.
Yeah, I've never seen you laugh so much. So good. I got a new audience for my jokes, I guess.
Yeah, seriously. Well, that's excellent. Anyway, well, that's awesome. We're here to, welcome to the show. That was a great joke. We're going to start, you'll be the funny guy. You know, I'm going to be the guy that gets kicked off the stage, mm-hmm. But whatever. But anyway, we're here to strike a nerve with aviation today, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Absolutely. It's an easy one to strike. Just since the fact that you and I can ramble on forever about this, so you know we're striking it right now. But there's a lot of different things that we kind of want to go over in aviation. It's just what are your current impressions about aviation?
Well, I think everyone knows, at least those that know me, and now we've introduced me to some new people out there. Just like every other pilot, I am very passionate about general aviation and aviation in general. But so much so that I have been working to find employment in the industry, not necessarily flying. I'm an older guy. And I always have to laugh that people constantly tell me, well, you haven't been making a living in aviation, therefore we can't hire you. And, it always strikes a nerve with me, as you said, because I've only been doing business for 30 years. I think I've learned a little bit of things that might be able to help, because on the other hand, we keep hearing from
the associations and the people out there, the manufacturers, that there's a problem in aviation. And they say, hey, aviation is trouble. You know, what's wrong with aviation?
Right. I don't think there's anything wrong with aviation. It's awesome.
I agree with you. And I think there's a bunch of us out there that all, just like we share the passion, we all share the same view that there are things that each of us can do to help aviation to get back on track, if you will. And it's really not aviation getting back on track, but those things that are getting in the way of us being at our maximum potential.
Right, absolutely. So there's an idea of that aviation is not broken, but you know, there's a problem. You know, what's the problem? Aviation is not the problem because aviation's awesome, right?
Right. The things that made us love aviation from whatever age, you know, with me, it was probably ages 5, 6, 7, and others pick it up later, are still there.
Right.
I still get a huge smile on my face when I go flying.
Right.
And even today, I was driving, we're at Papa Whiskey Kilo, is our home airport in the Chicagoland area. And I drove by the observation area, and there was a father, probably 30, 32 years old, and he had 3 children with him, none older than the age of 6. And I stopped by just to talk to him. And all 4 of them, the 3 kids and the father, just loved aviation. And actually, I said, come with me, and I took him over to the hangar and let him sit in an airplane. But it's that same thing that all of us feel. Even though they had never even been in an airplane before, they knew they had that passion, that spark inside them.
Right, absolutely. So there's a lot more to aviation than just flying and starting an airplane and going around. It's a much greater community. I would definitely agree with you that there's something, I'd hate to say wrong with aviation, but maybe the problem is us.
I think a lot of our wounds are self-inflicted.
Right, absolutely.
You know, I have a saying, if you always do what you always did, you always get what you always got. And I think it references people are trying to solve the new challenges that face so many industries, but they're thinking in old ways.
Right,
and
absolutely.
That's why, you know, I love the concept of this program, which is seeking out amazing people doing amazing things in aviation, because it really speaks to all of us. You and I don't have all the answers, but we want to be part of the solution.
Right.
And
absolutely.
I think there's a bunch of us out there, tens of thousands of us that feel the same. And a program like this, I think, starts to bind us together, creates a community within a community.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. If you know, for those listeners out there, if you think that there's a problem with aviation, hopefully you don't. But if you think the problem is us and would like to address one of the problems, we want to hear from you. You can dial us at area code 312-436-0356. You can also reach out to us on Twitter. Make sure that you can follow me on Twitter, which is L_H2OOO. And make sure that you tag your posts #SimpleFlight. We can get your questions and concerns on Twitter that way. Also, feel free to visit simpleflight.net, and there's some more contact information that you can reach out. And we want to hear what problems you think exist.
And what solutions, too.
Right,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So here's an interesting thought that, you know, if the problem isn't aviation, and it's we're the problem, you know, the users of it, if we created the problem, therefore we have the solution. You know, you and I, Al and Mark, don't necessarily have each solution. Mm-hmm. We have a solution to the problem that we created or somebody else created, but we can't fix the whole thing. But we all have a little piece of the solution.
Well, and I mentioned today that on the way over to the airport, I just stopped by, and I think I didn't introduce 4 new people to aviation, but I continued that spark again. I think they had it already. And, you know, I made my living in sales and sales management over the last 30 plus years. But it still applies the same. You know, in sales, we have a pipeline.
Right.
And when the economy gets tough and there aren't customers knocking at our door, we have to go out and find new customers.
Right.
And we always characterize it as hunters versus farmers. Farmers are when the business is there and you kind of farm the business, you harvest.
Right.
It's an easier sale. But those people that can go out and do demand generation, what I call demand gen, what everyone calls demand gen, to get more people in the pipeline so that at the bottom of that pipeline there's ends up, in this case, more pilots. And I think each of us can do that and be a part of that solution, finding new people to put into the pipeline, because they exist. We just have to find them.
Right. Well, what you know, part of the, let's expand our horizons outside of just the pilot certificate issue of licensed pilots. How do we get more pilots? Which is a big issue. You know, I think that there's so many different cool avenues and solutions that we can tackle with that. But you know, think about the business traveler that goes to O'Hare or JFK or LAX, and you know, the ticked off airline traveler. You know, they're part of aviation. They don't even know it. You know, so how do we spark that back into that? Flying used to be this beautiful, you know, event back in the 60s when you rode on, when you flew, or you know, when the airlines were back in the what we call the glory days, right?
Mm-hmm.
But how do we you know, address people like that, or who else exists, you know, if there's outside of just licensed pilots?
Well, and you really touch on a couple of different topics, but if we think about it, licensed pilots in terms of fixing, and I hate to use the word problem, but that's how it was positioned tonight. So it's, everything drives off of activity in aviation, and that generally is with the pilot. And once we have a certain number of and a growing industry of pilots, that drives additional products, services, you know, people to fix airplanes, people to clean airplanes, people to move luggage from a car to an airplane and then to get it lost in Toledo somewhere. So everything drives off the pilot population, whether it's commercial airliner, scheduled airliners. I know you fly for work as a corporate pilot,
right?
Or the general aviation guy like me that just, you know, tries to get out there whenever I can and go do my $100 hamburger. I wish it were only $100.
Yeah, right.
Right. But you know, I think back when I had that itch to scratch as a young man before I flew, I washed airplanes. I met up with a sales guy that sold airplanes and told him, hey, I'm going to wash airplanes for you. And in return, I'd like to get rides every now and then.
Right, absolutely. Right?
And I was in aviation. I wasn't a pilot, but I was in aviation. I was, again, satisfying that right. itch, if you will.
Right, absolutely. You know, one interesting job that I used to have is that was in aviation that you hardly even ever thought, you know, that even existed. And I always tell people that I've pretty much had, you know, almost every job, and there's so many jobs in aviation possible, but I've had a lot of aviation jobs. It's pretty much how all my bills get paid. But it started, you know, I've delivered every aviation job that I had. It's been from delivering lost airline luggage to airline pilot to corporate pilot. So here's an interesting aspect of aviation. That, you know, the lost airline baggage delivery guy.
Right.
You know, it's like that guy is. I was doing that down in Champaign when I was going to college, and one guy. On one of the first shows, a guy named Pat Brennan, good friend of mine, he and I delivered lost airline luggage. But we did it because it was fun, and that's that kind of got, you know. And you think, like, how is delivering lost airline luggage to people fun? You know, you're doing this in East Central Illinois, which is the University of Illinois in Champaign. And, you know, just on a Monday night, you'd be out at 3 a.m. in these small towns delivering bags to addresses that were literally, you know, 5600 North County Road to, you know, 3500 East, you know, whatever. And it's like, how is that fun? But it is. I don't know why. You always got to go back to the airport to pick up more bags. It was fun.
Exactly. That's the thing that, again, I think really connects us all. I again, a little bit of humor, but my father used to tell a joke that the guy that was at O'Hare complaining, and his job was to empty the lavatories from the airliners that land. And all he did was complain about how his job was so dirty and he was dealing with, you know, people's waste.
Yeah.
And someone said, well, if you hate it so much, why don't you get out of it? And he said, what? And get out of aviation? Right. So
yeah. Right.
it's aviation any way you look at it.
Right. Exactly. It's all very useful and worthwhile, jobs within aviation, and you know, without each one of them, you know, if the toilets get clogged up as an airline pilot, you know, they're going to break and you can't fly. So hip hip hurrah for the aviation lavatory guy. Yeah.
But you know, I think that there are some pretty smart people out there that do realize that, and you know, I have to give my hat off to Kevin Gould. I have a lot of faith in Kevin, and if people don't know Kevin Gould's name, Kevin is the former CEO of Piper Aircraft, and recently was announced as the CEO of Bendix King, you know, the radio people, a division of Honeywell.
Right.
And in the May issue of AOPA magazine, and quite honestly, I think it was in Flying Magazine as well, Kevin talked about that he wants GA people to come work for him.
You know, right.
Everyone else is saying, we want 10 years of experience doing this because, you know, I guess they want to continue the way things are going. How's that working for you?
Right.
Here's Kevin saying, you know what? We need to bring in active GA pilots because they are our customer. They understand.
Right.
And I had the pleasure of sitting down with Kevin at Oshkosh last week. Was that last week or the week before? Whenever it was. And it was a wonderful conversation, and he listened more than he talked. Of course, that meant I was talking more than I was listening, but that's what pilots do.
Yeah, right.
Right. So, but I appreciate that, and to me, that's the kind of leadership that we need to see from many organizations within GA, so we can start to tackle the very real challenges that exist not only for aviation, but in many industries.
Right. Well, I think that there's I kind of agree with you on that, but there's one thing that I do disagree.
Okay.
And that is that this movement, right, this people solving problems, right, I don't think it's going to come from an organization or an association or an advocate group or whatnot. Yeah, you know, it's going to be this movement from the $100 hamburger seeker to the airline pilot to the lavatory waste guy, you know, standing up and saying, hey, you know, something needs to change.
Right. And we don't disagree.
Right.
I just think it's refreshing to see an executive from a major organization stand up and talk like what I think they should. But I agree with you. I think it's going to come from the masses. You know, you and I were joking, Occupy Wall Street is better, should be like Occupy Runway.
Right.
Or something like that.
Exactly.
Because so there's something that's going to come from us being all part of the solution and being, you know, so totally passionate about this. We think about it, but we're not immersed in the business. I do it, you know, on the weekends, although I think about it, you know, throughout the week too. It's not how I make my living.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, the neat thing is, and you and I have talked about this before, that, you know, aviation is neat. It comes from all aspects. Without people like you in aviation would be pretty hard pressed to exist. You know, it's kind of this like this food chain type thing, right? You know,
yeah.
As soon as the GA pilots go away, then all the aircraft, you know, manufacturers go away. Then there's no more airplanes to learn how to fly in. So then there go the airline pilots. You know, it's a chain reaction, right? It's the animal
Absolutely.
Kingdom, right? But you end up having a I don't even know where I was going with this anymore, but this is pilot ADD. All pilots on frequency use caution. Pilot ADD is in full effect. But you know, so anyway, you know, it's so interconnected, you know, so there's, you know, everybody has kind of an equal voice.
Absolutely. And that's why you and I have been saying it's an equal responsibility. We're all accountable for the solution.
Right.
And, you know, I everything that I see, regardless where I relate it to what I know. So it's in sales, that's from as a customer. And so when people talk to me about, you know, the things going on in aviation and where do we find pilots, it seems like the surveys we're seeing are all focused on the declining pilot population, and 80% of people that start flight training don't finish.
Right.
So, and I think there is an issue with flight training, and I think I have some ideas that I've learned not only by my own thinking, but in discussions with some pretty smart people. But if you look at the numbers, and I was actually doing some studying, and in 2011, there were 617,000 active airman certificates held.
Right.
In 2002, it was 631. So it hasn't grown, but it's not like the bottom's fallen out. We had some bad years in 2007, 2009, and 2006. All three of those years were below 600,000. But to me, it's this keyword of active, because while they may say they're active because they have an active license, they may not be active. So there's two groups I think we need to focus on. One is the active pilot that's gone inactive. So how do we get them active again? And those that I'll call it latent pain.
Right.
They want to fly. They don't know it yet.
Right.
And it needs some catalyst to ignite that spark. And so I think that's going to be two different solutions, but I think there's solutions out there.
Right. Absolutely. No, I think that's a great point. You know, there's that inner desire. You know, it's like let's go back to sales, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you're a sales guy. So, you know, there's the, how do you sell this to people that don't even realize they want to do it yet? You know, that's an issue, and all these other issues that you talked about, how to fix the wounded pilot who quit, right? How do you recruit him back in? How do you overcome the, you know, those foul or bad ideas or thoughts that person has in aviation?
And it may not even be that. My own personal example, I got my license, and I don't know if I should admit this because now people don't know how old, but I got my license in 1976.
All right.
Yay. Yeah, you see, my AOPA number is only 6 digits. My member number is...
All right, yeah. Yeah.
And then 76, and I stopped flying in 1980. First, I got ill. And then came bills and a family, and next thing I know, it's 25 years later. I hadn't even thought about an airplane, which had been my passion for my first, you know, 20 years, 22 years of life.
Right.
And someone I work with said, "Hey, I've got a Cessna 172. You used to fly. You want to go flying?" I actually was scared. I have to admit it, because it was a 1970 something airplane. We're in 2004 at this time.
Yeah.
And I said, "Yeah, I think I'd like to go, you know. I hope, do you know how to fly?"
Yeah, right.
Right. He took me up, and as soon as we rotated off the ground, I said, "Oh my goodness. I forgot how much I love this."
Right.
The next day I had my medical. Within a week I was training again to get current. I've gotten my instrument rating since then, and have been in a fractional ownership program. I'm involved with a flying club. So it all started because someone got me up in the air, even though I had no active desire to do so. He almost twisted my arm, and it was like I couldn't believe that I had lived without it for 25 years.
Right. But the funny thing is that you're probably still existing within it, though.
Meaning what?
Well, you could, so you were, in those 25 years, did you ever go out and step on an airliner?
Yes.
You know, did you find yourself going to an airport and watching airplanes?
Not as much, but I did. You know, I was living in the mid-80s in St. Louis, and I have to admit, I would go out to the observation area, and I'd watch the airplanes, that whether it was the F-15s that they were building at McDonnell Douglas or the other stuff. And I even went up in the control tower, because it was easier to do back then.
Yeah.
Because I always had a love of air traffic control as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, awesome. I had it. But then by the time you hit the 90s, it was not part of my everyday thinking at all.
Right.
Right. But it just took one match, one event to reignite it with me. And as people that know me well will say, is I'm nuts about aviation, right? That's all I think about.
Yeah, seriously.
And somewhere there's a joke there, but we'll save that for another day.
I always say that, you know, I'm always posting on Facebook and Twitter that I have an aviation problem. It's disgusting, and I need to. If Betty Ford had a rehab clinic for aviation, I'd need to check in.
I think a lot of us would.
Yeah. Well,
what does my shirt say?
Yeah. Well, you're wearing a wonderful Oshkosh shirt. It says a quiet little drinking town with a flying problem. Don't the two go hand in hand beautifully?
Yeah. I hope not.
Yeah. Right. No, there's a, but it's kind of a pretty neat, it's a neat issue. I think there's a lot of aviation, you know, I like to, you know, there's this kind of weird vibe that, you know, we've been talking about, right? There's just, mm-hmm. it's not broken. Aviation isn't broken. Aviation still exists, you know, and now it's such a dependency, you know, the government won't let it not exist. You know, there's airline labor groups can't go on strike without approval. You know, this is because it's so vital to the economy. So there's, I guess the best way to put it is that aviation isn't running on all cylinders.
That's a good analogy or metaphor. I think that's right.
You know, and it's skipping a beat. So if it would be interested to hear some of our listeners. Ideas and thinkings of where they think that aviation isn't running on all cylinders. So if you have any good ideas, give us a call, 312-436-0356. You can post your questions. You're afraid of calling and being on the show. You can post your questions on Facebook. Look me up on Al Waterloo and post your questions there. Or you can post them on Twitter. And make sure that you include the tag your post with hashtag Simple Flight. And, you know, I just think that there's that is, you know, how do we need to clear that fouled mag and get it running rich and lean again, you know?
Well, and I think there's, you know, lots of solutions. I'm interested to hear if any of our listeners, you know, come up with some additional ideas, but I mentioned the huge dropout rate of training.
Right.
And I have to compliment you, and I get to see you interact with students, and you're not there to build hours. You're not there as a pilot first. I think you're there as an educator first, and that has translated to being in demand, and I think it's translated to people continuing. You
right.
know, why don't you share with the audience some of the things that you do so that people say, you know what, I can't wait for my next lesson because of what Al Waterloo is doing for me.
Yeah, well, I think that there's a, you know, I used to be like that, you know, or what you kind of touched upon of just say, oh, I did use it for a thing to build hours, but right. Now it's kind of changed. It's, you know, you look at these, let me see, the first realization is that, you know, when you log an hour of flight time in your logbook, it's not, you know, the hours are kind of meaningless. It's just a number that you're writing with a pen. It's just like a dollar bill. It's a piece of paper, but it's worth something. But at the end of the day, it's just a piece of paper. You know what I mean? So there, but you know, each hour when you, the significance of keeping a logbook is because each flight has a story and you're mm-hmm. logging that story. You know, so it's not necessarily building flight time, but gaining experience and logging aviation stories. So that's something I don't think I've ever really told to anybody, but I had a realization about that a couple years ago. But you know, people ask how much flight time you have. It doesn't even matter at the end of the day. You and I have different flight times, but you know, you have, you know, 1,000 different stories that I don't have. So, you know, we're on this level playing ground. So you and I, you know, however you look at it, you know, I'm not better than you. You're not better than me. We're equals. Right?
Did you ever see that movie or the documentary 1/6 Right about Van Nuys?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you remember that when they talked about the logbook, the guy said that at the beginning of his logbook, he wrote, "This is a love story."
Yeah.
I found return to.
To be honest with you, I actually cried in that moment. I did. I'm serious. I even wrote a blog post about it, and I was just like, "Hey, you know what? That's actually, if so, I immediately put myself in his shoes, thinking that if I lost my logbook, I'd be devastated."
Right. Yeah. No, I'm the same way, and it's sometimes when I fill it in, even as of late, I there's not enough space, good landing, visual and all that. But in when I was a younger person, I put a little bit more of the emotion, you know.
Right.
Saw this, how wonderful, you know, greased this. It was a grease landing.
Right.
So on and so forth.
Right. Absolutely. It's kind of interesting because, you know, not the more that you that I, you know, got a lot of logbook entries to enter. Right. And it gets cumbersome. So you look for shortcuts and things like that. But it's kind of neat is I remember when I was catching up on my logbook, and you'll probably slap my hand for this, but I let my logbook go for 2 years.
Oh, my God. Give me that hand. Yeah. I'm going to slap it.
Seriously. But, you know, I'm not the only one that has a problem like that. So if you have logbook problems, tweet us. It's Simple Flight. Make sure you hashtag it Simple Flight. But anyway, it's interesting. Even 2 years back, and I'm writing each flight in to my logbook, I'm sitting there. I'm like, holy cow. I remember each flight, you know. It's just enough of a trigger to rewind my memory to that flight, you know, whether it's an airline flight, a fun flight, a corporate flight, a training flight. It's pretty neat. So I think a big thing is if you can get, you know, one, students to realize that hey, you know, if you and I were to sit down in an airplane, you know, we're equals, right? So right. In you're kind of helping me or, you know, I'm trying to help you build logbook stories in your training. That's all I'm trying to do. So now we've taken it from a cumbersome task of meeting a minimum requirement by the FARs, and now we've turned it into a let's build our stories and have fun at it type attitude. You know, that whole mentality shift for flight training, you know, it makes it fun. What kind of story, what's going to be unique about this flight that I'm going to always remember?
So, and I think you're selling yourself short, because while you do that, I happen to know that you do a good job of, as you've told me, owning the student's goal.
Right.
Right. It's not about just even I'm going to get him a ticket called a private pilot license, but you're going to help them achieve a goal.
Right.
You know, I guess that there's no other way to put it. And so by you owning that goal, I think people sense that, and you incorporate it into your training. I've seen you train. You're not, I wouldn't say unconventional, but certainly the scenarios you put people are important to them because they have to do with their ultimate goal.
Right. Yeah. And that's very important. I think that is from a student standpoint, if you take ownership of that, right, and you say, okay, well now we have a context to put your license in rather than, you know, turning it into a negative context, you know, let's call it the general, you know, the other category, right? If you're going to list all these categories on why you get your license, and it's to, you know, not kill yourself, right? So that's kind of the catch-all, you know. If you don't have a goal, well, we're going to get your pilot's license so you can learn how to not kill yourself, which is such a horrible and misconstrued way of thinking. But anyway, you know, if you can go and figure out why ultimately the student is getting their license, you can absolutely, you know, they're going to have a riot at it, you know. And, you know, whether it be, you know, flying just to take a friend up or take their wife out on a hot date or whatever, you know, to flying for business or, you know, just to go see somebody. You know, you can train around that.
Right. And that's what I think is so great, because you're right. It seems like everything we do in aviation during the training process is focused on the good thing, safety, but it's like safety is everything and the value comes second.
Right.
Or what you do and many other great CFIs is focus on the value and learning how to achieve that value in a safe manner. It's not quite subliminal, but it's a small point, but it makes a huge difference in terms of the attitude and the focus you bring to training.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that there's people need to realize that when you do go out and flight train, you know, the student needs to take ownership of that goal too. You know, I'll be the first guy to tell the student, hey, you need to take ownership of your training. And if you're not, you know, you're ultimately paying for it. and you're exchanging a lot of money out for this. It's kind of like a doc. I call it the doctor paradigm. You know, just because I say something, it's not law. You know, just like if you were to go into the doctor and the doctor says, oh, we need to cut your arm off, and you're thinking like, oh, I don't know why, it works perfectly fine, you know, and then you go to the operating table and then you cut it off and the guy's like, oh, well, I don't think we need to really cut it off, but, you know, we did it anyway. You know, it's like you get a second opinion. So if you're not getting what you want from me, fire me.
Right.
You know, you're the one paying for it. You're the customer. You're the client. Fire me. You know, find somebody else. Somebody, I know that there's somebody else out there to help, you know, and get you to that point.
Absolutely. And actually a very important part of the flying club I'm involved with, and I know a lot of flying clubs and organizations do this, we have a pilot bill of rights that basically says, if you're not getting what you want out of the instructor, change. You know, no one takes anything personally, and some people want a CFI that's on top of them and pushing. Others want a very calm cockpit and let me make mistakes. So it's kind of respectful of each of us having our own best ways we learn and making sure we get a match, because it is expensive. But
it is.
When you, regardless of the methodology, again, this attitude of owning the student's goals, I think is so key, and that permeates through all great CFIs. So
yeah,
I think we need to see that as well.
Right, absolutely. I think there's some interesting things with training that could really, you know, old school versus new school. You know, there's a lot of cool things out there that instructors and flight schools can do to stay on top of everything, you know, and you know, broadcast their information or help students learn. Like the one thing I always say is, you know, like you can there's electronic code of federal regulations, electronic FARs that are the most up to date, you know, copy of the rules for flying that you can access for free, and it's easily searchable. So, you know, this, instead of showing up to the learning table with this big binder or this big bound book that costs $20 of 2012 regulations, you know what, look it up online. You know, people would rather do that, and you can hit Control F and find the topic that you're looking for and find it twice as quick.
Right. Yeah, actually, and you know, I happen to have a tablet and have the FARs on there, and I, you know, I love research and studying, but it with the internet and with devices like this, it just makes it so easy to access just the information you need.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. I actually sent an email out to one of the pilot examiners that is a club member of the flying club that we're in. And I asked them, I'm like, hey, do you find, you know, in this new digital era, is it acceptable for a student to show up to a check ride with an iPad with all the electronic FARs and the electronic approach plates and electronic AFDs? And he said, absolutely.
Yeah, sure. You know, it brings up something. We made fun at the start of the show because I talked about old jokes and all, and maybe you were too young to know them. But, you know, I like to think of the training environment needs to recognize that some of the things we do don't make sense anymore. You know, I use the analogy in math. They don't teach kids how to use a slide rule.
Right.
And yet we learned how to use a slide rule way back when. Because there wasn't such a thing as a calculator. And they've moved beyond that. And yet sometimes I feel like in aviation, we haven't moved beyond it. So for those that are a little old school and love working with ADF, you know, I understand if it's in the airplane, you're supposed to use it, although most people put the in-op sticker on it. I don't think it adds value. And I'll say some might consider blasphemy, but as we move to GPS, you know, we should all, I guess, know how to use a VOR, but we spend so much time on VOR tracking, and at some point, I don't know when, it may not be appropriate anymore. And so we have to be attuned to how today's youth learns, their need for not only ease of use, but speed of use. You know, I think it's going to drive a different set of avionics. It's going to drive a different set of tools and methodologies if we want to get them involved.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, you and I talked about the pre-flight, right?
Yeah.
You spend 45 minutes in a pre-flight, and then you spend 45 minutes flying. Today's youth doesn't like that.
Right.
I used to, when I took a car ride, we checked the tires, put a little penny
right
to make sure the treads were right depth. We don't do that anymore. We take on that extra risk. There are certain things to shorten a pre-flight, especially if it's the second or third flight of the day, that shouldn't be taboo to get them flying faster.
Right.
Because that's what today's pilot needs.
You know what? It's a kind of interesting because I was talking with a Cessna sales agent at Oshkosh. And we had a great conversation, and the one very big key issue that this person brought up was that people don't want to invest the time or the money, and they want the immediate gratification of everything, and they want it right now. They figure that they can pay the money right now, they should get it.
Right.
You know, you can do it like on iTunes. iTunes kind of programs that. So, I want a song, boom, it downloads. Okay, you have the song. It's the same thing as buying a CD, mm-hmm. right? Okay, yeah, I'm going to pay $10, boom, I have it right now. It's in my hand. Now, this is something that I think, there's no way that you can pay, $5,000 and get your pilot's license today. It's not going to be mailed to you, right? There's a certain amount of effort, time. There's so many different commitments. There's a financial, economical, time, commitments that go into all these things, and there's kind of that mentality shift. People have changed, so people aren't going to want to learn that way anymore. But so how can we adopt new ways of flight training that can get people excited about aviation? But accommodate the new mentality, but facilitate what the regulations say. It's kind of a weird problem.
Well, you articulated it perfectly, and we don't have all the answers. But again, something I know that you do is you incorporate their end goal, which if it's to conduct business, with the pilot's license, you incorporate that into their training.
Yeah, right.
Right? So that now they're starting to achieve the end goal before they have their license. And I think that helps today's youth. And I don't mean to paint them in a negative light. It's just the nature of the beast, right? That's you're right, that instant gratification. So there's ways to give them tastes of it. And hopefully that's it, because ultimately we do need them to go through a certain set of minimum requirements that takes tremendous commitment on their part,
right,
to be a pilot that can achieve their goals in a safe manner.
Right, absolutely. And I think that's a pretty big, important, I kind of discovered that in flight training, is that you can show them what's wrong with giving them the taste of the end result. Let's train to that. Let's show you what you're going to be able to do, and I think that actually throws fuel on the fire of why they want to get their license. It just reconfirms and they want to do more and really enjoy everything. And it's kind of it's kind of a special thing. Last time I went out and tried to get my license, I got my ATP, not my license, but I went out and got my ATP. Right. And I asked if I could bring people along. Like, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And it's like, hey, it's something I want to share with people. But, there's so many, internal rules that said, no, this is a quick rinse, get in, get out type of thing, which kind of facilitated some of the, immediate effect. But anyway, there is a, If you can train and kind of, there's nothing wrong with bringing people along on lessons. You know what I mean?
Oh, so, absolutely not. And I love to do it. Matter of fact, as I think I told you, but to share with the audience, that last Thursday, this is Sunday, so just a few days ago, I sat in the back seat of an airplane for about 7 hours.
Right.
On a few trips that we took that day.
Right.
I learned so much. It didn't cost me a penny.
Right. Right?
The guys in the front were paying. It was a CFII and a student that is a certificated pilot but learning a new airplane. And the learning I got by being in the back seat, the motivation, all of those things was all made possible because a student and an instructor said, yeah, sit in the back and come along.
Right.
And be part of it.
Right. Be part of the discussion, you know, and then, you know, there's a benefit that you can add to it. You know, there's certainly a, it strengthens the camaraderie or the social aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it lightens the mood. You know, there's a steep gradient in flight training, I think. You know, the instructor is the end all be all, and then the student, you know, is the you know, is the young, you know, the young grasshopper looking up, right? So, you know, I think with that third person, it kind of lightens the mood. Everybody puts their pants on the same way at the end of the day, right?
I heard you put your pants on a little bit different, but that's okay.
Yeah, well, I did lose a belt notch. I need to, but anyway, there's a so anyway, it's kind of nice. It kind of opens up this door and it produces a great environment for learning. If you bring your you know, somebody along that you really want to take up for an airplane, you're paying for an airplane ride when you're a student going out and you know, learning how to fly, right?
Right.
You know, so if you're paying for it, you should be able to bring whoever you want with, you know, within safety limits of the airplane and all that. But you don't necessarily want to put them on in a spin, but
now you tell me.
Yeah, exactly. Unless if you're going on one of those kind of lessons, but yeah, I mean, you can do that.
Actually, it's brings back a memory when I got my private pilot license back in 1976. We used to have spin training as part of the private pilot curriculum. I don't think it is anymore, although I confess I don't know, but I was learning in a Piper 140, which became a Piper Warrior, but then we did spin training in a Cessna 150. And the first thing I did when I got my private pilot license is I would take people up that had never been in an airplane and do spins with them.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. Somehow, I guess it put me in a feeling of power. I don't know what was going on. Now it's like, oh my God, no, don't right. Put me in a spin.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, it's funny how your risk profile changes when you're 20 years old versus when you're 50 something. Right.
Exactly. All right, and same with the airplane. You know, you don't want to go, you know, depending on what kind of airplane, you don't want to go flying in a 50-year-old or spin training in a 50-year-old airplane sometimes either.
Yeah, I don't. Well, you can't do it in a lot of the newer ones, but yeah, no, it's funny.
Right. Well, okay. Guess what?
What?
We got a couple questions.
All right.
All right. So the first question we got was from our online chat communication. So if you go to you're listening to the show, athanolive.com. There's a little chat feature, you know, that I'm kind of sitting here monitoring. And we have somebody that asked, why are instructors a bit reserved when it comes to letting their students solo for the first time?
I'm not in position to answer that. I'm going to defer to the expert. I'll let that be you.
Me? I don't know. I'm looking around the room for the expert. There's
the room. But, we're outside at the Northbrook VOR. What are you talking about?
Anyway, inside pilot joke warning. But anyway, I don't know. I recently had a student solo, and it was a lot of fun. It was interesting because I felt that there was you know, I wanted the student to be perfect. You know, I'm just like, I want you to do the best you possibly, you know, I'm taking ownership of the goal. But then there is this point where I realize that I have to let go, you know, and you know, let them spread their wings in a sense. And that sounds incredibly cliche, But, you know, there was one point where I said, hey, for the student's best benefit, I need to get out of the airplane. And I, as I'm sitting there and I'm watching the first takeoff and landing, I'm so excited to see them do what they set out to do, right?
Yeah.
they're doing it, they're killing it, they absolutely love it. And you know, I'm also going through my head, oh my God, my name is in the logbook, it's signed, and it's got signed so many times, and I signed them off that, you know, I've got all the, I own a condo that's an asset that's attached to my, you know, this is going to be thrown in the lawsuit, da 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 da. You know, there's a lot going on. You know, you are putting a lot of a lot on the line, you know, when you look at it. So I'm trying to teach this person to be as safe as they can be and to have as much fun as they can. And, you know, I want to make sure that do a good enough job, you know.
But, you know, I have a question for you that kind of leads off this. I talked to people who learned when I did, and you soloed in 15, that's 15 hours, and now it's not uncommon to see 50
right.
hours before someone solos, and certainly there are those that do it much quicker and some that take longer. So I don't mean to characterize everyone, but let's just say my sense is it takes a lot longer to solo today than it did 30 years ago. Is that because of technologically advanced aircraft? Is that because our risk profile has changed? What do you think has caused that?
I think it's everything. You know, there's depending on where you're at. You know, I was down when I learned how to fly. It was in 2002 in rural Arkansas. You know, so you take off, you could do all your maneuvers, steep turns, S turns, slow flight, all that in the traffic pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in a training environment here in Chicago, where it's pretty dense and you're learning at one of the busiest airports in the country, you can't do that. So there's some type of travel time to and from to get to the area where you need to practice your maneuvers. So there's a little bit of that going on. But I also think that the risk profile is there. You know, that at the end of the day, you know, the instructor is responsible for everything,
mm-hmm.
right? And as an aviation kit keeps getting more tuned to, oh, we're going to train to not kill yourself, you know, we want to be absolutely sure, you know, and we're our own worst enemies, which ultimately hurts the student. So at some point, I remember on this point, I'm like, I want my student to do so well. I want to be perfect and do everything right. And all of a sudden, I just realized I'm like, I need to get out of the airplane. You know, this guy's ready. This guy's absolutely ready. You know, the last trip around the traffic pattern and the trip before that, I was bored. I'm like, That's the question that I ask myself. You know, when am I a passenger and am I bored? If I answer yes to both those, then I get out of the plane. And I think that's rather than, oh, is life insurance set up? You know, blah, blah, blah. Do I have an attorney? Do I have this in case? You know, I'm not going to tell the student to throw the logbook on the fire. No, because there will be no fire, right? Because they're going to have a great time. They're going to come back. We're going to cut shirt tail off and have a celebration.
Well, and I, you know, to that point, some people have said to me it's because of all the automation. And we are fortunate enough in the organization you and I fly with to have glass panels and such. But it still comes down, they have two rudder pedals, a yoke, and a throttle. And, you know, I think you're right on the risk profile, but I'm wondering if there isn't something else that's driving up the hours, because I truly don't see a lot of people soloing
yeah.
at 15 hours.
Yeah.
And I don't think I was any great pilot. That was the norm.
I think that that flying airplanes has changed from stick and rudder, and this is a big thing that I try to teach is stick and rudder skills mm-hmm. that will translate to any airplane that you fly. Piper Cub to 747, stick and rudder, there's no substitution for it. You know, if you're going to teach to fly power settings and enjoy you know, power settings, air speeds, and all that, as soon as you get into a bigger or slower airplane, all that's different. So this.
Right.
You're going to have no frame of reference for, you know, the student's going to have no frame of reference. So trying to teach a procedure and perfect it is easy, but it's hard to do when a student doesn't understand stick and rudder skills. You know, these procedures are built on stick and rudder skills, and you're supposed to nail them every single time.
Right.
But, you know, and that's the way the airlines do it, too, because it's there's an economical factor behind it, because it's a lot easier to teach pilots to train, you know, to fly procedures rather than stick and rudder.